to use the recreation facilities exclusively. They get more time in the gymnasium now than they ever did before. And the squadron briefing room has more recreational equipment than the officer's lounge here. Lujain Forge spends more time as a social secretary for your brood than she does training. General, I'm building a squadron that will be given difficult missions, which means I need them to trust each other. If that means they have to be cliquish, then so be it.
Akbar rose from his chair and walked over to where a blue globe of water hung suspended in a repulsor lift cage. The apparatus negated gravity, allowing the water to form a perfect globe. Within it, a school of small fish with neon blue and gold stripes flashed this way and that. The Mon Cal studied it for a moment, then inclined his head toward Salm.
It does not strike me, General, that your earlier complaints about the TAARS tampering involved how Rogue Squadron spends its recreational time.
No, sir, but all of this is indicative of the difficulties the Rogues are creating. I have three squadrons of bombers training here, as well as two other fighter squadrons. The morale of my troops suffers as the Rogues get rewarded for ignoring operational rules.
Akbar gave Saum a wall-eyed stare.
Your specific complaint about TAARS?
Saum's brown eyes smoldered.
Rogue Squadron's ability to alter top-secret and proprietary software packages has serious security ramifications, especially with Tycho Selchu serving as the executive officer of that unit.
Wedge's jaw dropped.
Admiral, Tycho had nothing to do with the incident in the first place. And second, Tycho has done nothing to show himself to be a risk.
Akbar clasped his hands together at his back.
I agree to both of your points, but you would acknowledge that General Salm's concerns are valid.
The Rogue Squadron's leader hesitated, never voicing the hot denial he had prepared as he heard the question. While he did not doubt Tycho's loyalty, he could see that taking chances was not wise.
Yes, sir.
Good, because I am going to make an extraordinary request of you.
Yes, sir.
By making Rogue Squadron operational within the week.
What? Wedge felt as if he'd been snared by a Stokely stun net.
It's only been a month since the roster was finalized, sir. Advanced training takes 6 months normally, four if it's rushed. We're not ready.
Akbar returned to his desk and tapped the datapad.
That is not what your numbers suggest.
Admiral, you know there's more than just numbers to a unit. My people are good pilots, but they're still green. I need more time.
Salm folded his arms.
Rogue Squadron has gone into battle before with less training.
Yes, and I lost a lot of good men and women because of it.
He opened his arms and appealed to Akbar.
Admiral, I've not even run any hyperjump exercises with these pilots.
Ah, but I thought all the pilots were pre-screened for being astronav capable.
They are, but...
Wedge was going to protest that Gavin Darklighter needed more work with astronavigation, but Lujain had been tutoring him and reported Gavin was a natural.
Just like his cousin. Damn it. I don't like this. I would still prefer having time to take them through more drills. We all would like that luxury, Commander, but we don't have it.
Salm frowned.
I'm taking my Y-wings, the wing you so neatly chewed up, operational in 2 weeks.
Wedge fell silent.
My people are far closer to battle-ready than Salm's. As always, the needs of the Rebellion outweigh the needs of its people. But this we knew going in.
Admiral, can I at least run some astronav exercises to get my people working together when they come out of hyperspace?
By all means, Commander. In fact, I have the perfect assignment for you to use in that regard.
Akbar touched his datapad screen in two or three locations, and the lights in his office dimmed. As they did so, a swirling disk of stars appeared suspended between ceiling and floor. It tipped up on edge, and a green circle slowly zoomed in on Kaminor, locating it just outside the dense galactic core.
I will be moving Rogue Squadron from here to Talassia in the Morobe system.
Even before another green circle could appear and pinpoint the new system, Wedge's eyes narrowed. That's coreward of here. Akbar nodded.
There has been much debate in the Provisional Council about how much we should proceed in the war against the Empire. Much of what we have discussed has been paralleled in the conversations held by the vast majority of citizens, rebel and imperial alike.
We're going after Coruscant? Imperial Center?
Akbar's chin fringe twitched.
We are given little choice, really. If we wish to overthrow the last remnants of the Empire, that goal being an exercise that may well take generations to complete, mind you. Many of the Moths are adopting a wait-and-see attitude about the New Republic. Others, like Zins, have proclaimed themselves warlords and are doing what they can to consolidate their holdings with those of weaker neighbors. Any of these warlords could decide to turn his forces toward Coruscant, and by taking it, proclaim himself heir to Palpatine's throne.
So we have to get there first. Or at least appear to be bent upon that goal, discouraging others from usurping our place in the galaxy.
Psalm tried to keep his voice even, but his desire to see the rebels in power hurried his words.
These pretenders will learn that we have not labored so long just to give them an opportunity to rape and pillage whole systems.
Wedge agreed with the general sentiment, but he knew breaking Coruscant open and taking the world would be far from simple.
It almost seems to me that an expedient alternative is to let some Moths push themselves forward and have Iceheart deal with them.
Your opinion was also heard in our councils. It was decided that leaving anyone to her tender mercies was a crime of grand proportion.
Isan Izard had risen to fill the power vacuum left by the Emperor's death. The daughter of Palpatine's last internal security director, she came of age in the Emperor's court. Wedge had heard rumors that she had been the Emperor's lover for a time, but he had no way of verifying that story. What he did know was that she had betrayed her father to the Emperor, claiming he was going to defect to the Alliance. Her father was put to death immediately, and it was said she triggered the blaster shot that killed him. The Emperor elevated her to replace her father, and in his absence, she did a remarkable job in holding the core of the Empire together. The Mon Calamari warrior pointed to the galactic display.
From Talassia, Rogue Squadron will provide escort to ships pushing even deeper, setting up safe worlds and supply depots. You will be but one unit of many probing the central Imperial defenses.
You want to see how hard Iceheart will hit back? Gauge strength based on speed and the nature of response?
Yes. As well as determining supply routes for possible disruption.
That made perfect sense to Wedge. Though space provided a limitless number of ways to get from one point to another, some simple basic rules governed how and where ships traveled. A ship attained speed and direction before jumping to light speed, and then maintained velocity in hyperspace. A ship moving fast enough could skirt phenomena like black holes, cutting parsecs off a more conservative and safer route. Because objects with mass, stars, black holes, planets, and Imperial Interdictor class cruisers exerted influence over hyperspace, they had to be navigated around. Their presence could abort a hyperspace flight, and, in the case of a black hole or a star, could spell disaster for any ship that traveled too close to them. Making a trip through hyperspace required precise calculations that took advantage of a ship's speed and mass to get it safely to its destination. Because hazards to navigation diminished the number of calculable routes between places, trade tended to move through predictable corridors. Since traveling between stars was not inexpensive, merchants chose routes that allowed them to visit the most profitable systems along the way. These routes, including systems where ships leave hyperspace to change their travel vectors, were well known, and piracy was not uncommon. Disrupting Imperial supply routes would have a double effect for the rebellion. Not only would it deprive Imperial garrisons of needed materiel for making war, but it would provide those same materials to the rebellion. While the New Republic and the Empire used different starfighters and capital ships, supplies like blasters, rations, and bacta could easily be employed by either side. Wedge ran a hand along the edge of his unshaven jaw.
I understand the mission, and I appreciate the urgency for it. I do have a question, though.
Akbar nodded.
Please, Commander.
Rogue Squadron will do the job. But I was wondering if we were advanced for it because we're the unit that can do the job, or if we're being used as a symbol.
Frankly asked.
The Mon Cal's coloration brightened to a salmon pink on the dome of his head.
I argued against employing you this soon, but others aptly pointed out that if you were not put in place now, our operations might not have time to succeed. Rogue Squadron is a symbol in the Alliance, and by positioning you to drive against the Empire, we show we have made a commitment to liberating everyone in the Empire.
Wedge's mouth became dry. But the only way our use can function as a symbol is if our use is well publicized. And that publicity must get out to the warlords you expect to be frightened off by our presence.
Akbar's shoulders slumped ever so slightly.
Your words are ripples of my discussions with the Council. Borsk Phalia is quite persuasive, and he has Mon Mothma's ear in many things.
Wedge looked at Psalm.
And you're worried about Tycho being a security risk? Tycho Selchu did not risk his life to get the Alliance the location of the second Death Star. No, he only risked his life to destroy that Death Star.
Akbar stepped between his subordinates.
Please, gentlemen, if I want petty bickering, I can go to more council meetings. It is important for you to air your grievances, but I will not have you fight and refight the same battles over and over again.
Sorry, sir. My apologies, General. Accepted, Commander.
I beg your pardon, Admiral.
Akbar nodded slowly.
Commander Antilles, in an effort to minimize damage done by the public profile being given your mission, we will keep your destination secret. This means your pilots will not know where they will be stationed, and they will only be told that they are going on an extended training exercise. Logistics and Supply Corps staffers have prepared lists of equipment that cover anything your unit might not carry with it on the trip. We have an Imperial shuttle that Captain Selchu will use to bring supplies on your journey.
Nav data will be fed out to my pilots prior to each jump?
Exactly. You should give your flight leaders numerous routes for which they will compute navigation solutions. Then you choose the appropriate one and have it communicated to your squadron at each change of course.
The Mon Cal pointed at the representation of Talassia on the display, and it zoomed in.
The Marobe system is a red-yellow binary, and Talassia is the fourth planet in orbit around the yellow primary. The world is cool and moist, with indigenous insect and reptilian life. There are mammals there as well, feral descendants of the animals brought in for an early farming colony. Your base is on the largest of the island continents. The atmosphere is thick. Fog is common, but the world is safe.
What happened to the farming colony?
Over the centuries, most of the children emigrated to worlds where they could see the stars and didn't have to work so hard. The last group of them made the mistake of harboring a Jedi after the Clone Wars. Lord Vader destroyed them as an example. settlement ruins are on your island, but our people have reported there is nothing of interest left behind there.
Home sweet home.
Wedge smiled.
When are we to be on station?
A week from now.
That's not much time.
I know.
Akbar shrugged his shoulders.
It was all I could buy you. May the Force be with you, Commander Antilles. I hope you won't need it.
Kirtan Lor clutched his hands at the small of his back so they would stop trembling.
I am in your debt, Madam Director, and at your service.
How kind of you to say so, Agent Lor.
Isan Izard thumbed a small device. The lights in the room slowly brightened while shields descended over the windows. The rising illumination revealed the room to have a tall ceiling with dark wooden beams, curving up from the four corners to meet in an apex above the center of the floor. The walls and carpet shared the same deep blue, though a strip of carpet, the same bright red as worn by Imperial guards, bordered the floor at the edge of the wall. In the far corner, he saw a desk and chairs that were elegant, yet far from ornate, in keeping with the general Spartan nature of the room. It struck him as odd that a large room that was all but empty could seem so decadently opulent. The only thing the room seemed rich in was wasted space. Then it struck him. On a world that is so crowded with so many people, wasting this amount of space is the height of luxury. Izard's predatory pacing in the center of the room snatched his attention away from the subtle messages of the architecture and appointments. She wore an admiral's uniform, complete with boots, jodhpurs, and a dress jacket, though the garments were red. A black armband circled the upper part of her left arm, and the jacket bore no rank insignia or cylinders at all. Yet even without the external signs of rank, her intensity and the deliberation with which she moved radiated power. Though he would have put her age at a dozen years older than his own, he found her attractive. Tall and slender, she wore her black hair long, and the white streaks descending from her temples made her seem more exotic than middle-aged. Her face appeared classically beautiful to him. A strong jaw, sharp cheekbones, a high forehead, a gracefully small nose, and large eyes were all the elements that most women would have killed to possess, or would have paid to have given to them. Even as he catalogued all the bits and pieces of her that should have triggered some sort of lust in him, and the aura of power surrounding her was terribly exciting, fear overrode any glimmerings of carnal desire. When she looked at him, with dark brows accenting her eyes, he knew where the menace dwelt in her. One eye was ice blue, as cold as Hoth, and as cruel as a hut in a sporting mood. The other eye, the left one, was a molten red, with golden highlights that flashed with fiery determination. The left eye told him that any effort by him that was not fully devoted to her service would be met with the bloodless retribution promised by her cold right eye. Kirtan shivered, and she smiled.
Agent Lor, your personal file has a number of interesting inputs. You are rated as having a visual memory retention rate of nearly 100%.
He nodded.
If I read it or see it, I remember it.
This can be a useful tool, if applied correctly.
Izard's expression lost some of its hardness, though this in no way made Kirtan feel as if he were any safer.
In the report about Bastra, you mentioned not using scotopinol during his interrogation, because he had been dosing himself with loteramine. This was a precaution you learned to take because of a case on Corellia, where doing just that had negative effects, yes?
the suspect died.
Your report says you used the fact that the Lotira mine masks the presence of blastonecrosis to confront Bastra with his own mortality. When that did not prove effective, you began conventional interrogation.
Kirtan nodded.
Sleep deprivation, protein starvation, coercive holographic and auditory illusions taken from what I knew of him. It all proved quite promising, until the blastonecrosis began to make his whole body septic. I then initiated treatment for the condition.
And this treatment killed him?
Her eyes became mismatched slits.
Do you know why?
He had a reaction to the bacter used to treat him.
Do you know why?
Kirtan was about to offer her the explanation the MD-5 droid had given him when Bastra died in the Bacta tank, but he knew that she would not accept it.
I do not.
Izard hesitated for a second, and Kirtan knew he had escaped punishment by being truthful.
What does ZX-1449F mean to you, if anything?
He instantly recognized the number, but held back his answer until he could sort out the details and put them in a coherent form.
That is the lot number of a batch of Bacta that was contaminated by the Ashran rebels on Thyfera. It made its way to Imperial Center and infected nearly 2 million soldiers and citizens. It rendered them allergic to Bacta.
Kirtan frowned.
But Gil Bastra never was on Imperial Center.
You do not know that for a fact. Perhaps he was here.
She shook her head slowly.
It does not matter, because he could have run into that batch of Bacta almost anywhere. It was ordered disposed of, and I saw to it that much of it was funneled to the black market. That, however, is not important. What is important is this. Blastonecrosis is a condition that affected roughly 2% of the people who were dosed with that particular lot of Bacta. An MD droid would have inquired of a patient if he had been dosed with Bacta in the last 2 years.
But because I ordered treatment and didn't recognize the significance of the disease, Gil Bastra died.
No.
Izard's eyes hardened.
Gil Bastra committed suicide.
What?
His reports about you are in your file. Your slicer was able to excise them from the Corellian records, but not my records. A man is best evaluated by his enemies.
Kirtan's stomach slowly collapsed in on itself.
Those evaluations were prejudiced against me.
Perhaps. But Bastra was amazingly perceptive. He wrote that you rely on your memory too much, trusting that retention of information can somehow compensate for an insufficient amount of analysis. Because you know so much, like the obscure fact about the fatal interaction of lotiramine and scotopanol, that you didn't look beyond Bastra's obvious line of defense to see how much deeper things had gone. If you had, you would have known about his possible Bacta allergy, and he might still be with us.
She slowly exhaled and tugged at the hem of her scarlet jacket.
Bastra knew you well enough to know he'd be dead soon. That gave him enough hope to feed you useless information. He held out as long as he could because he was playing for more time for his confederates to further sever ties with their past.
The intelligence agent realized right then that the display of bravado Bastra had provided during their first meeting on the Expeditious had not been a false and hollow thing. Kirtan's face burned as he heard again everything Bastra had said, this time with the man's mocking tones intact and brutal.
What I had seen as my brilliance in ferreting out his errors had been him playing to my sense of superiority.
leading me on after him like a nerf eager for slaughter. For 2 years I've been a fool.
A revelation hit him strongly enough to make him tremble.
I've been fooled for even longer than the 2 years I've chased them down, haven't I?
Very good, Agent Law.
Izard's expression lightened slightly, as if she were on the verge of smiling, but she did not.
The responsibility for your deception is not wholly your own. Our training and indoctrination tends to make agents and soldiers believe in their own infallibility. This has proved to be a detriment to the Empire. You are not alone in falling prey to it. Even the late Emperor had his blind spots.
Kirtan decided to avoid the invitation to question the Emperor's wisdom, or lack thereof, and instead followed up on his previous question.
The falling out Bastra and Horn had was faked. I thought the reason for it was stupid, and assumed they were stupid for being at odds over it.
This is even better, Agent Law.
I feel as if in realizing how badly I was used, I can see more depth to things.
A blind spot is eliminated, letting you see more of what goes on around you.
She ran an index finger along her jaw.
If you had read Bastra's evaluations of you, instead of having them destroyed, you would have been able to come to this epiphany sooner.
He nodded confidently.
And I would have had them by now.
And you were doing so well.
Izard's face contorted into a snarl.
Don't backslide.
Kirtan blushed.
I'm sorry.
More's the pity that you are not. You assume superiority where there is none.
She folded her arms across her chest.
The Emperor likewise assumed that if he destroyed all the Jedi Knights, that his Jedi Knight and a handful of Force-trained special agents would be sufficient to control the galaxy. He did not see, though I tried to warn him, the impossibility of proving that all the Jedi had been destroyed, and that no other Jedi could rise against him. His obsession with the Jedi blinded him to the real threat posed by opposition leaders who are no more intelligent or remarkable than you are. As a result, the Empire is falling apart, and the rebels are threatening to supplant the Empire with their own new republic.
Kirtan nodded.
And you wish to restore the Empire?
No.
Her denial came cold enough to freeze carbonite.
My goal is to destroy the rebellion. Imperial restoration can only be accomplished if the rebels are eliminated. And that can only be accomplished if we blunt their military, sorely stress their administration, and crush their spirits. These goals are interwoven, and I have operatives, like you, working on all levels to bring my plans to fruition. Can you withstand the pressure of so vital a mission?
Kirtan slowly nodded.
I can. How may I serve you?
This time she did smile, and Kirtan wished she had not.
Your target is to cut the heart out of the rebellion. You will be the death of Rogue Squadron.
Excuse me?
Kirtan frowned, wondering if he had heard her incorrectly.
I am no fighter pilot. I know nothing about Rogue Squadron.
Ah, but you have expertise I want and desire. You served on Corellia, and the unit's commander is Corellian.
Wedge Antilles. I know.
Kirtan raised his hands.
But that is not to say I know him. I don't. I don't even know anything about the squadron.
But you can learn.
Yes, I can learn.
And you shall learn.
She nodded slowly toward him, then brought her head up abruptly.
You will also find you have a personal stake in this.
Kirtan aborted a wince.
Yes? Our source within the squadron tells us that a friend of yours is a flight leader. A remarkable skill.
One of Izard's earlier statements ran through his mind again.
A man is best evaluated by his enemies.
Corrin Horn.
You see? You already know more about them than you thought you did.
Isan Izard gave him an even stare.
Do you accept being the instrument of Rogue Squadron's destruction?
With pleasure, Madam Director.
Kirtan smiled to himself.
With the utmost of pleasure indeed.
XIII. Corrin forced himself to relax. Though Commander Antilles had cast the trip as an exercise in astronavigation and hyperspace jumping, deep down in his gut, Corrin thought a lot was being left unsaid. He was certain that if they had been going out on a formal patrol or escort mission, Wedge would have told them so. The fact that he hadn't said anything conflicted with the mission requirement of packing up and stowing their personal gear in their X-wings. This left Corrin thinking something more than an exercise was taking place. Because of his training exercise scores, Corrin had been promoted to lieutenant and given the command of 3-flight. As an officer, he had expected Wedge would trust him enough to let him know what was really going on. Even so, with his background, he had great respect for security, and that put a brake on his uneasiness.
Those concerns don't matter. Getting through the drill does.
Heading outbound from Folor's scarred gray surface, Corrin flew lead for Rogue Squadron's 3-flight. Oral was back to starboard, while Lujain and Endorni were off to port, similarly staggered front and back. Within the unit, they had comm unit call signs of Rogue 9 through 12, respectively, though for this exercise, they would be operating as semi-independent flight.
Let's keep it close, 3-flight. Whistler, will you send all our jump coordinates and speed parameters? Have your R2s double-check it, then lock the route.
He checked his data screen for the positions of the first 2 X-Wing flights, and Tycho Selchu bringing up the rear in a captured Lambda-class shuttle, forbidden.
We follow 1-flight on this leg, then 2-flight on the next one. After that, we're leading, so let's be prepared.
The members of his flight signaled their readiness to jump, so Corrin keyed his comlink over to the command frequency.
3-flight, ready to jump on your mark, Rogue One.
Good. All flights, 5 seconds to mark.
With Wedge's reply, Whistler began counting down for the 5 seconds. Corrin watched the seconds click off the digital display. When it read 0, he engaged the X-Wing's hyperdrive and sat back as the stars filled the view screen. Just as the color threatened to overwhelm him with its intensity, his snub fighter leaped into hyperspace and moved beyond the ability of the light to abuse him. The first leg was to take them about an hour and had them flying along the plane of the galactic dish, moving against the swirl of the galaxy itself. The course brought them in ever so slightly toward the core, which was good, because the databases containing information about navigation hazards got progressively better as they headed toward the core. And Coruscant. Corrin knew the Imperial capital was not their intended target, at least not for this flight, but he felt certain they would get there eventually. His more immediate concern, however, was plotting the course for the 3rd leg of the jump. While he had not been told their final destination, Commander Antilles had given him a list of 20 starting and ending points, and he had calculated the best courses he could see for making those jumps. The direction, speed, and duration of the 1st leg allowed him to eliminate all but 2 of the courses given to Rosati for solution for the 2nd leg, and that narrowing down of ending points meant he only had 2 plans of his own to refine. The first course of his which would take flight further along the disk and outside the most populated and advanced section of the galaxy, had been plotted pretty tightly. Several black hole clusters narrowed leeway as far as that course was concerned. He glanced at it again and decided it couldn't be refined anymore.
Whistler, bring up the course for the Marobe system.
The astromech droid hooted at him as numbers and graphics scrolled up on the screen.
Yes, I know you did the best you could on this plotting. Freeze output there.
He tapped the glass on the monitor.
At the Chorax system, you have us skirting it by 0.25 parsecs. There's only one planetary mass in that system, and the sun isn't that big. Since the Chorax system comes up so early in our leg, if you pull us another tenth of a parsec closer, we should come out of hyperspace close enough to Marobe's habitable planets that we won't need to make an in-system jump to find gravity if we need it.
The astromech wailed at him. Corrin laughed.
You're correct. The data you used to compute the course indicated giving the system a wider berth. But that's because you're using merchant data, and they're afraid of pirates and smugglers working the system. We're a squadron of X-Wings.
We have nothing to worry about. With astronavigation and hyperspace jumping being so tricky a business, courses were plotted as often as not to brush by inhabited systems, even if they were inhabited by social misfits and undesirables. If a hyperdrive went out in mid-flight, or refused to engage after a course correction between jumps, being within hailing distance of worlds from which help could easily be summoned was a blessing. Trying to find a ship that had misjumped to some random location in the galaxy was next to impossible, as all those who hunted after the fabled Katana fleet had learned since its disappearance. The first leg of the journey ended uneventfully. Two flight, with Rosati flying lead, took over from one flight and brought the squadron around on its new heading. Just before they made the jump to light speed, Commander Antilles shot Corrin the coordinates for the third jump.
So, it's Marobe after all.
Corrin called the flight plan up for one last time, ignoring Whistler's disgusted wail, and went over it. The course appeared as nearly perfect as possible, given the ships they were using. A ship capable of greater speed could have trimmed even more distance off the run by getting closer to the Chorax system. The greater speed would allow it to resist the influence of the star's hyperspace mass shadow. Without the resistance, the ship would be dragged back into real space in the system, and, more likely than not, would be unable to escape the sun's gravitational grasp.
Fortunately, X-Wings have enough power to get us through.
Corrin glanced at his reactor fuel level readings.
The hyperdrives barely sipped fuel, while the sublight engines gulped it.
Running up to a light-speed jump burned a lot of fuel, though not as much as maneuvering through a dogfight. But nothing they had done on their journey so far had been that taxing on the engines or fuel supply.
By the time we make my jump, we'll still be at 87% of a full load. More than enough to make it to the Marobe system and back home again.
The squadron came out of hyperspace, and Corrin eased his stick to port.
Squadron, come about to a heading of 230 degrees and depress 12 degrees. Flight plan on its way to you.
He pushed his stick forward until the X-Wing's nose dipped slightly.
Jump to light speed in 5.
The jump to hyperspace for his legs seemed somehow smoother and more effortless than the previous two. He knew that sensation was an illusion, and he wondered about it for a moment or two. It occurred to him that the reason he was more at ease with his jump was because he had been in control of it. Mistakes made in calculating a hyperspace jump could be fatal, and Corrin had never been good about putting responsibility for his life in another person's hands.
But I don't have to worry about a mistake on this leg, since I did the calculations.
A keening whistle from his astromech made him smile.
Fine. You did the calculations, with no help from me at all.
Whistler's hooting became more urgent. The astromech started scrolling sensor data over the cockpit screen, but none of it made sense to Corrin.
There's another stellar mass in the Chorax system? That's impossible! Unless...
Before he could broadcast a warning to the other members of Rogue Squadron, the automatic safety cutout on the hyperdrive kicked in. The snub fighter burst through an incandescent white wall and into the outer reaches of the Chorax system, and right into the middle of a running light fight. Corrin threw the stick hard to port and pushed it forward. Rogue 11, break up, Star! He trusted Oral would follow him, moving down and to the left, which cleared the way for the rest of the squadron to enter the system. Lock S-foils into attack position! He reached up and flipped the switch with his right hand. Whistler, have you ID'd those ships yet? The little droid shrieked urgently back at him. Anything you can give me! The big ship, Corrin knew immediately, was an Imperial Interdictor cruiser. Its quartet of gravity well projectors allowed it to create a hyperspace shadow roughly equivalent to that of a fair-sized star. The interdictors had proved effective in ambushing smugglers and pirates, and the presence of one of the 600-meter-long triangular cruisers in the Chorax system was not wholly unexpected. It hadn't been there to trap them, however. Running from the cruiser, which Whistler identified as the Black Asp, was a modified Baudo-class star yacht. About three times as long as his X-Wing, the yacht had a broad triangular shape to it that was softened by the gentle down-curve of the wings. It looked almost organic in origin, as if it should have been swimming through space instead of rocketing along on its twin engine's ion thrust. Corrin had seen plenty of modified yachts in his time with Corellian security, and this one even looked vaguely familiar. Most often the yachts were modified to haul contraband. While he had no love for smugglers, he had even less for the Empire.
Enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Whistler bleated sharply. Corrin glanced at his screen, then keyed his comm. Ties! Squints! Interceptors! Looks like a dozen of them. He looked up through his cockpit canopy and felt panic when he couldn't see with the naked eye what his instrument showed so plainly on his monitor. Rogue One, what are your orders? Wedge's voice came back cool.
Engage them, but watch the cruiser's guns.
I copy that. Rogue 10, on me.
Oral double-clicked his comm, indicating understanding of Corrin's order. That action seemed, like Commander Antilles' order, to betray no nervousness at all. The bitter taste slicking Corrin's tongue surprised him, because he'd flown against imps in real life, and endless simulator battles. He'd never been this bad before. Nervous, yes, but not edging toward losing it.
Pull yourself together, Corrin!
His hand snaked up and touched the coin he wore. Your squadron mates and the folks in that yacht are counting on you. Because the break they'd executed had taken them down, the interdictor and its ties were coming in above their line of sight. Pulling back on his stick, Corrin thumbed a switch that put all power in the forward shield.
All power to forward shield, switching to proton torpedoes.
A targeting box appeared on the heads-up display, and Corrin maneuvered the X-Wing to drop the sight on the lead interceptor. The range indicator dropped numbers and digits as the X-Wing closed on the Imperial fighter.
Easy, easy. Let yourself go. Just like in training.
He nudged the flight stick to the left and framed the incoming squint perfectly. The box went red, and a strident beep filled the cockpit. Corrin hit the trigger, and the first torpedo sped in at its target. Another torpedo streaked past him and raced toward an interceptor. Both of the Imperial ships broke hard, but Oral's torpedo reduced his target to fire and scrap metal. Corrin's missile missed his intended target, so he switched back to lasers and evened his shields out.
Good shot, Ten! Scratch one, Squint!
Fingering the coin he wore beneath his flight suit, Corrin swallowed hard, then keyed his comm unit.
Cover me! I'm going after mine.
Ratcheting the throttle up to full, Corrin swooped the X-Wing up on its port stabilizers, then corkscrewed down through a roll that brought him out on the interceptor's tail. He linked his offside lasers, so they fired two at a time and triggered a burst that burned armor from the interceptor's bent wings, but failed to destroy it. The squint drifted to the left, then came up in a roll that brought it around and over Corrin's line of flight. If he continues that roll, I'll overshoot him, and he'll end up on my tail. Corrin pushed the stick to the left, making a wide turn to port that opened distance from the interceptor, but still let the Imperial ship slip in behind him.
Laurel cannot get him, Nine.
I know, Ten. Not to worry. Keeping one eye on the rangefinder, Corrin kept his X-Wing on the long loop. Come on. You know you want me. If you had proton torps, I'd be free space ions. But you don't. Yes, Whistler, I know what I'm doing. Feeling some of his confidence returning, he shrugged. At least, I'm pretty sure I do. The interceptor pilot came up fast and flew in a straight line to get quickly to the same point in space where Corrin could get slowly with his great loop. Seeing his prey close in fast, Corrin centered and hauled back on his stick, tightening his turn considerably and jamming his body down in his seat. The X-Wing shot across the TIE's line of flight, barely 20 meters behind the ball and wing craft. Yanking the stick to starboard, Corrin rolled the fighter 180 degrees. He pulled the stick back to his breastbone, bringing the X-Wing's nose up in another turn that reversed his previous course. Leveling the fighter out, he sailed in right on the TIE's tail, his long S-turn having allowed him to let it overshoot him by a fair distance. A lethal distance. Corrin lined the interceptor up in the sights and blew it apart with two laser blasts. As pieces of the disintegrating ship whirled past him, he keyed his comm unit. Ten, report!
Cover Ten, heading 90 degrees.
I have your wing, Ten. Guiding the stick to the right, he saw Oral's X-Wing shoot ahead of him and into the ion wake of an interceptor. The Gan's first shot struck sparks and armor from the fighter's central ball. One more, Oral, and you have him. Nine and Ten, break hard port! Get out of there! Oral's compliance with Wedge's order came immediately. His sharp turn took him across Corrin's line of flight, forcing Corrin to yank back on his stick and roll to starboard. He leveled out and started to turn to port, but Whistler's shrill whine filled the cockpit. The stick slammed back into Corrin's chest, pinning him in his ejection chair as the droid brought the X-Wing's nose up. Red crept into the corners of Corrin's vision, and the stick's pressure against his breastbone made breathing hard. The vast expanse of the Black Asp's bulk filled his viewscreen. By all the souls of Alderaan! A blue bolt of ion cannon energy sizzled in and battered down the X-Wing's shields. Whistler yowled, and the stick went slack for a moment, allowing Corrin to act. He slapped the stick hard to port, bringing the X-Wing up in a snap roll that put the interdictor beneath his feet. He started to pull back on the stick to show the cruiser his stern and rocket pull away from it, but he felt a tingle run through him as another ion blast partially caught the starboard stabilizer foils. The astromech screams died abruptly, and Corrin was slammed against the left side of the cockpit. Even without seeing the stars swirling around him like dust motes in a Tatooine sand tornado, he knew what had happened. The ion blast had knocked out his starboard sublight engines, leaving the pair on the port side of the ship operating at full power and without competition. This put him into a flat spin, with his stern chasing his nose, completely out of control. But at least I'm hard to hit. The ion blast, in addition to shutting Whistler off, had killed all his cockpit electronics and acceleration compensator. The only thing he could do, he knew, was to shut his engines down and go for a restart. Until he had some sort of power, or until that cruiser slaps a tractor beam on me, the X-Wing would spin like a gyroscope. Gotta power down! That was easier said than done. the emergency shutdown panel had been placed on the right side of the cockpit. Mashed against the opposite side by centrifugal force, it remained just beyond the reach of his outstretched fingers. Gritting his teeth, Corin levered himself off the cockpit wall with his left elbow and tried to hit the panel. The stick slammed him back into place, pinning him. Corin caught it with his right hand and tried to pry it forward. Pain radiated out from where the stick had jammed his medallion into his breastbone. So much for that being terribly lucky. The stick made it painful to breathe, adding one more unnecessary complication to his predicament. A sense of urgency boiled up in him, overriding panic instead of boosting it. Let me go! He redoubled his effort to move the stick. It resisted at first, but Corin refused to be daunted. Concentrating with every fiber of his being, he pushed, and the stick yielded. Centimeter by centimeter, he forced it away from himself. Yes, I'm free. Corin shoved the stick as far as it would go to the left, then used it to pull himself away from the port side of the cockpit. With his left hand on the top of the stick, he brought his elbow up, inch by inch, scraping it past various switches and knobs that had died with the rest of the ship. When his arm came up above the top of the stick, he lunged to the right, letting the stick slip beneath his armpit, and hit the shutdown panel with his right elbow. The thrumming of the port engines died, leaving him alone with the sound of his own breathing in the cockpit. The ship still spun and showed no signs of slowing, but without friction or other resistance in the vacuum of space, it would continue to spin forever. Corin relaxed slightly in relief at cutting the engines off, and was rewarded by being bashed back against the port side of the cockpit. His helmet hit a hard stanchion, leaving him a touch dazed. Along with the spin-induced nausea, it made him hope someone would shoot him and end his misery. That flash of despair lasted for a moment, until another spark of pain spread out from his breastbone. Kill us they might, but I'm not gonna make it easy for them. He slid his right hand across his chest, past the medallion and his left shoulder, and tipped three switches up. A bit farther along, he lifted a plasteel plate that covered a recessed red button, then punched that button and hoped for the best. What he wanted to hear was the return of the engine thrum. But what he got was nothing. Ignition circuits must be fried. Ugh, there has to be something else I can do. Without the engines, he had no power. The primary power cells and the reserve power cells for the lasers probably had enough energy in them to at least give him communications, attitude control jets, and limited sensors. But getting at it from inside the cockpit presented him a problem. It's not like I can just land this monster and do some manual cross-wiring. Corin laughed out loud. No, but I can manually land this thing. He brought his left leg up and hooked a small tab on the cockpit wall with his heel. It flipped out a small bar that sat in a groove. Corin centered his foot on the bar and pumped it down. It came back up beneath his foot, and he pushed it down again and again. From the nose of the fighter, he heard metallic pops and clicks. The bar was connected to a small generator that put out enough current to deploy the fighter's landing gear. Extending them did nothing to affect the spin, but the payoff Corin hoped for wouldn't come until the gear locked into place. With a shudder, he felt throughout the ship. The landing gear snapped into their fully deployed positions. The monitor in the cockpit lit up again,
and the stick began to feel alive in his left hand. Laughing aloud, Corin took the stick in his right hand and tugged it over to the starboard side of the cockpit. The spin began to slow. He fingered the medallion with his left hand. Because no power landings would be seriously harmful to most life forms, extending the landing gear on the fighter opened a circuit that allowed the primary and reserve power cells to drive the S-foil impeller jets for simple maneuvering and to kick in the repulsor lift drives. The power cell tap tended to be used primarily by Tex for moving the ships around in repair and maintenance facilities. Because running the fusion engines up for full maneuvering power in enclosed places is generally considered harmful to most living creatures. Corin tried his restart again, with the same results as before. Diagnostics told him he'd lost one of the starboard incom phi inverted lateral stabilizers, and the engine just wouldn't start with power levels fluctuating all over the place. No engines. But maybe I have sensors and communication. He brought those systems online, but got nothing from sensors, and a lot of static covering voices on the comm. This is Rogue 9! I could use some help here! Waiting for a reply, he flipped on the proton torpedo launch circuits. Without sensors, his ability to hit anything was nil, but at least he could get a shot off or two. And I'm probably going to need it. Above and to starboard, he saw the Black Asp. Rogue Squadron had regrouped to form a screen between the interdictor and the smuggler. He couldn't tell how many rogues were left, and the occasional glint of sunlight off TIE Interceptor's quadanium solar panels told him a few of the squints still existed. But there seemed to be far more rogues than there were TIEs, and that was a good sign. The interdictor ventured in close to the fight, its lasers and ion cannons blazing away with green and blue bolts. The energy streams filled space with tangles and knots as the gunners tried to target the elusive X-wings. Though he had been hit fairly easily, he knew his collision avoidance maneuver had kept him in one place long enough for the gunners to hit him, and that the only reason they hadn't was because he'd ventured far closer to the interdictor than he should have. He half heard a command crackle in over the comm, but he couldn't make sense of it. Out beyond his ship's nose, he saw a series of proton torpedo launches from the X-Wings. They came in at the large ship from a multitude of angles. While the power in each of the torpedoes was hardly a threat to the interdictor, the combined damage of a volley like that was enough to batter down its forward shield. The concave energy wall glowed a sickly yellow before it imploded, and Corin thought he saw several torpedoes explode against the interdictory hull. Yeah, rogues! Corin laughed aloud. Oh, Whistler, you're gonna be sorry you missed this! The interdictor brought its nose up to pull the vulnerable bow away from the X-Wings. It could repair the damaged shield by pumping more energy into it, but that would require the shutting down of the gravity well projectors. That, in turn, would allow the X-Wings and the yacht to escape, turning the whole engagement into a draw. If you don't count the vaped squints. The big ship executed a roll that combined with the loop to reverse the cruiser's course. He's running! They've driven it off! Yes! His jubilance died as he realized that meant the cruiser was heading back in his direction, and the surviving TIE interceptors were flying along in its wake like fledgling Minox chasing a slow freighter. Whistler, you're lucky you're not seeing this. It'll be ugly.
Rogue 9, do you copy?
I copy! Corin didn't immediately recognize the voice. I'm on partial power. Whistler's dead and I'm blinder than a Y-wing.
This is Rogue Null. You have squints coming your way. I mark two.
Oh, more good news. Thanks, Null. Be my guest. Corin craned his neck to see where Tycho and the shuttle were, but he couldn't see it. I'm naked here, so please get them off me?
Not possible, Nine. Clear your sensors to 354.3.
What? Corin frowned as he saw the TIE getting closer. I'm a sitting hut here!
So you have indicated, Nine. Clear your sensors.
Corrin punched the frequency code into the keypad under his left hand.
Done, Null!
Happy hunting, Nine.
Corrin's targeting display came back alive, and his monitor showed targeting telemetry data from the Forbidden. Beyond the display, Corrin saw the TIEs juke to try to shuck the shuttle, but Tycho managed to keep his sights locked on the lead interceptor, despite flying a slower, less agile craft. The HUD went red, and Corrin hummed an imitation of Whistler's target tone. He squeezed the trigger on his stick twice, sending two torpedoes streaking out at the lead interceptor. Lead's gone, Null. Give me number two. The display flickered, then Corrin nudged the X-Wing around and launched two more missiles at the interceptor boxed in red on his tactical display. So intent had the Imperial pilots been on losing the shuttle behind them, they had no chance to react to the missiles shooting in at them. The first pilot died without being able to execute even the most basic of evasive maneuvers. The proton torpedoes blasted through the cockpit ball, ripping the craft to bits and igniting the ion engine fuel into a swollen ball of fire. The second set of missiles lanced through the fireball and blew one wing off their target. That squint careened away, somersaulting and twisting wildly through space. Bits and pieces of it flew off into the void. Then it exploded brilliantly, blotting out the image of the interdictor going to light speed.
Great shooting, Nine!
Corrin shook his head. Greater flying, Null. I did the easy part.
The kills are yours, Corrin. Three confirmed. The best today.
The Corellian pilot shrugged. Maybe today wasn't so unlucky after all.
Glad you feel that way, Nine.
Why, Captain?
You had the most kills. When we get where we're going, all the drinks are on you.
Corrin happily popped the cockpit canopy seals on his X-Wing after the yacht killed its maneuvering jets and the thick fog descended over the ships. At Chorax, the yacht had come back and picked him up, using landing claws to capture the X-Wing's landing gear. This left his ship clinging to the dorsal hull of the yacht like a dauber wasp on the back of a bird. He didn't particularly like the situation, but it was a long walk from Chorax to Talassia and the Morobe sector, and he liked the idea of leaving his fighter and Whistler behind even less than being carried into port. He'd shut down all systems except for life support, so he had no communication with the yacht's pilot. Corrin had been impressed with how smooth the landing was at the primitive spaceport. A dense fog hid almost everything, and what little he could see in the backwash of maneuvering jets seemed overgrown with dark green ivy. He saw dim shapes that resembled buildings, but most of them were covered with sufficient plant life that he wondered if the New Republic hadn't grown the base instead of building it. He stood and stretched, then doffed his helmet and gloves and put them on the seat of his command couch. Vaulting from the cockpit, he landed heavily on the yacht's hull. Oof, more gravity here than I expected. Corrin looked for a ladder to let himself down, but couldn't find one. Instead, he walked along the curved wing and jumped down to the ground from the lowest point. His knees buckled with the impact, and he went down on all fours.
Either there is more gravity here than I expect, or that fight really wrung it out of me.
As he straightened up and scraped mud from the knees of his red jumpsuit, he knew both of his assumptions were probably correct.
I'm lucky to be alive.
A hatch opened with a hiss on the underside of the yacht, and a boarding ramp slowly descended. Corrin turned toward the ramp, wiping his hands off on his thighs. A Sulliston descended first, followed by an insectoid maintenance droid of Verpine manufacture. Corrin nodded a salute at them, but they ignored him as they waited at the base of the ramp. Corrin assumed they were waiting for the captain of the ship, a person he had assumed to be male, since very few of the independent smugglers were female. As the captain descended the ramp, Corin had his assumption exploded by his first glimpse of shapely long legs encased in boots and a form-fitting dark blue jumpsuit. A gun belt encircled her slender waist, and long black hair fell to mid-back. She grabbed the ramp's forward support and swung around to face him in a carefree manner. And Corin was very taken with the smile lighting up her beautiful face. He wiped his hands again on his jumpsuit. "Thanks for the ride back here." She returned his smile as she shortened the distance between them.
"Thanks for the save back there."
"My pleasure." He extended his hand to her.
"I'm Corin Horn."
Something dangerous flashed through her brown eyes.
"Are you any relation to Hal Horn?"
"He is, was, my father."
"Why?" "Because he hounded my father and had him sent to Kessel."
She poked him in the chest, right where the flight stick had bruised him.
"If I'd known who you were, I'd have left you there."
Corin recoiled in surprise, and for the first time he saw the patch on the shoulder of her jumpsuit. It showed a Corellian sea ray that had a bar where its eyes should have been. Because of the polarized thread used to embroider the black eye bar, a little vertical white line passed through it, running side to side.
"I know that crest. I knew this ship was familiar. This is the Pulsar Skate.
If I'd known Booster Tarek was bringing me in, I'd have stayed out there."
"I can see you two have already met."
Corin whirled around and quickly saluted Wedge.
"Yes, sir."
The woman planted her fists on her narrow hips.
"You didn't tell me who this pilot was because you knew I'd not have transported him, right?"
Wedge smiled easily.
"I suspected there might have been some friction. How have you been, Mirax?"
"Paying for spare parts and fuel, Wedge."
Mirax kissed Wedge on the cheek.
"I've also been collecting stories about you from all over the galaxy. Your parents would have been proud."
Wedge nodded solemnly.
"I'd like to hope so."
Corin's green eyes narrowed.
"Sir, you realize the Pulsar Skate is a ship with a well-documented history of smuggling, and that Booster Tarek is one of the more notorious smugglers who ever flew out of Corellia."
Corin's commander smiled.
"I know all about the Skate, Lieutenant Horn. I was about 15 years old when I helped replace the fusion chamber on that starboard engine. Mirax's father regularly used my parents' fueling station for repairs and refueling."
"But Booster used to smuggle glitter..."
Wedge cut him off with a scowl.
"He also helped me track down the pirates who destroyed the fueling station and killed my parents. Pirates who destroyed it while fleeing Corellian security, and whom Corsec never caught."
"And that makes it all right?"
"No, Lieutenant. It just puts things in perspective."
Wedge gave Mirax a hug around her shoulders.
"Mirax isn't her father. Ever since he retired, she's been running a lot of supplies for the Alliance."
He then turned and gave her a hard stare.
"And Corin isn't his father either. If he'd not made some last-minute adjustments to the course we were taking, we'd not have ended up in the Chorax system to save you."
Mirax glanced down at the ground. The anger in her expression eased slightly, aided and abetted by the color rising to her cheeks.
"You're right, Wedge. I'm still bleeding off the stress of being jumped like that. The Black Asps came out of hyperspace right on my exit vector and grabbed me in place. Someone sold me out."
Corin snorted.
"No honor among thieves."
Wedge frowned at him.
"More like Imperial credits buying more loyalty than the promise of Alliance credits."
Mirax shrugged her shoulders.
"Some of us find those promises more safe than letting the Empire get their hooks into us."
She extended her hand to Corin.
"I want to apologize for my behavior, Lieutenant."
Corin shook her hand.
"Apology accepted. And I apologize as well. I'm still rattled after getting fired upon by a cruiser. My R2 is down and I'm a bit worried.
She smiled, and some of the tension in his chest eased.
I understand. If I can help in any way, I appreciate the offer.
Corrin looked over at Wedge.
I should probably see to getting the X-Wing unloaded, and Whistler's getting repaired.
In a moment, Lieutenant. I want to speak with you first. He jerked a thumb at the pulsar skate. Mirax, do you know where your shipment was going?
I was supposed to rendezvous with a ship for transfer or coordinates.
She shrugged.
According to the manifest, it was a lot of basic stuff for setting up a base. You could probably use most of it here.
I don't doubt it. Wedge fished a cylindrical comlink from a pocket of his flight suit and flicked it on with his thumb. Antilles to M-Tray.
M-Tray here, sir. I've been trying to reach you since we landed.
Wedge rolled his eyes skyward.
I'm sure you have. No time to talk now. I need you to get a salvage crew with a lift crane over here to get Horn's X-Wing in our R2 unit. You also need to get the ship's manifest from the Pulsar Skate. Find out where that shipment of supplies was going, and see if you can't arrange for what we need to remain here.
Yes, sir. As I was saying, sir.
Antilles out.
Wedge turned the comlink off and shoved it deep into his pocket again.
Tycho said he didn't have any trouble with the droid on the trip out here. But why not? I can't imagine.
Mirax arched an eyebrow at Wedge.
So you send him out here to talk with me?
Believe me, he's not the worst protocol droid on our side. Not by a long shot.
Wedge winked at her.
Just give him the data card, retreat to the skate, and threaten to shoot him if he comes aboard.
Make sure you shoot twice.
I'll remember that, Lieutenant.
Mirax sighed.
Wouldn't it be easier if I just downloaded the manifest to your central computer?
Wedge winced.
Right now, he is our central computer.
True. This isn't exactly Coruscant Rimward. It makes the outlier worlds look civilized.
I'm glad you understand.
Wedge tossed her an abbreviated salute.
We will talk more later, Mirax. Lieutenant, if you'll follow me.
Corrin fell in step with his commander.
You wanted to say something to me, sir?
It's never again going to be quite like that first time.
Wedge smiled.